the joke about self-isolation for theologians is that it's pretty much our ordinary life anyway. By disposition, we tend to enjoy our own company, and we spend large periods of time sitting, reading books on our own in quiet. So life is pretty much going as normal for me, except for the fact that I'm sharing my space with my 20-month-old son, who doesn't seem to respect theology at all, and instead wants only to do drawings and to read books and to watch videos of nursery rhymes. So once we get a balance between those two things, I think I'm going to enjoy this period of lockdown. More generally, I do think that it will be, if I can talk in these terms, it'll be a spiritually testing time for people who might not naturally talk in terms of spirituality, because they'll find that there's a great chasm within themselves, which is both a positive thing but also a terrifying thing. And eventually the Netflix binge television will no longer be satisfying, and they will have to make peace with themselves in a way that our society doesn't very often confront us with. So I think it'll be an interesting experiment for us.
Absolutely. I mean, all of the daily activities that really keep us going and, you know, give us a sense of purpose have now mostly been stripped away to a large degree. So we're just left with, almost in a spiritual or meditative way, where you just have to sit with the self and contemplate that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, but it's also illuminating that at the end of the Wuhan lockdown, 88 couples immediately went to the divorce courts. I think that it will be very taxing and straining on people who are not used to spending large periods of time with just one or two other people or on their own. And I also think I've got a very good friend who's a theologian in Australia who pointed out to me this morning that it's an unbelievably threatening time for people who live in contexts of domestic abuse. That's there are angles here to this that go beyond the obvious. And I think that we as a society need to be aware of the people who aren't just going to be bored or find the whole thing tedious, but for whom being locked in their own house with their apparent loved ones is in fact, it's a fearsome prospect. So there's a whole range of spectra that we have to consider when we think about the societal reaction to lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, even for children, I mean, I know some people mentioned that perhaps the meal that they get at school might be the only meal that they get.
Yeah.
You know, and now that's gone.
I know across Britain there's initiatives to try to counteract that, because they figured that there are close to a million children who probably rely on the nutritional content of their meal, which I suppose exposes the ways in which our individualistic society has been stitched together in a very threadbare fashion. And one shock to the system, and it's suddenly starting to deteriorate all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we were talking about, was, you know, your article that you wrote for Jesuit.ie on the weakened immunity of an individualistic society. So just that idea that we're not set up very well for these types of shocks, and that something like this really brings that to the fore.
Yeah, for the last 40 years or so, we've been engaged in a large-scale political experiment to try to maximize efficiency in every aspect of our society. Obviously, there are benefits to this around the growth of the economy and the rise in our levels of prosperity, but there were costs that we weren't accounting for. And we know ourselves, when we're running at 98%, when we're really pushing ourselves for long periods of time, things begin to slip. We know this in our own private lives, in terms of our health and our relationships. We know it in our professional lives. And what we're seeing now is this communal and social cost of having no margin space, no surplus that we're able to draw upon, except altruism and the decency of the common ordinary person, which is significant and important. But what we're going to see, I think, over the next 2, 4, and 6 weeks is that all the community activism in the world isn't going to be enough to fight back against COVID-19.
I mean, it is quite sobering to see how quickly businesses shut down, because, I mean, you see these businesses and they seem to be thriving. And then suddenly, you know, 2 weeks without work or 2 weeks without business and they're shut down. You know, I mean, it really shows that everybody is running a very tight ship and is kind of at the pin of their collar, as you say, running at like nearly 98%. There isn't really any room for saying, oh, well, we could just take a few weeks off if we needed.
Yeah, and that presses a really important question to us, which is, what's the point of all of our prosperity if it disappears and evaporates so rapidly? Surely there's a better way for us to build an economy that is sustainable and that's durable and resilient in the face of these kinds of shocks. I think epidemiologists will tell us now that there's nothing unknown about the pandemic. We knew that a pandemic was coming. The only thing that was unknown was we didn't know exactly when. So like an earthquake or a tornado, these are not unpredictable events. They're the definition of predictable. They will happen. So we should be engineering our society so that we're able to adapt to them. Instead, what we've done is engineered our society to maximize profit. And how poor an investment that is going to be tragically exposed this summer.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting that you say that because pandemics have been on the increase and people have pointed out that they're on the increase. And a lot of it is linked to how intensively we continue to farm and exploit different resources, particularly animals in this context, like that worth pushing them to their max as well, the maximum profit that we can get in terms of growing a chicken as quickly as possible or a pig as quickly as possible. Like there is no margin of error there too. And that's, we've been told by epidemiologists and people who look into these things that that's a breeding ground for disaster.
Yeah, and I mean, there's great hope within me that this is going to be a turning point and that we collectively see the nature of this societal insanity and choose a different option. And it really is that simple. In 2008, the economic system faced a cataclysm and we responded by bailing out the very large corporations. And now in 2020, we have an opportunity to bail out the very small individuals and small businesses and therefore kick in motion a revolution in terms of how we think about what all of our prosperity is for. The businesses that have gone to the wall in the last couple of hours even, they're viable businesses. And if we as a society and as a political state decide that we're going to put those businesses back in action the moment COVID is defeated, we can do that. The laws of the market are not natural laws. We can change them. And I think that faced with actual natural phenomena like this virus, it's a great opportunity for us to decide to change things for the better.
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, is the kind of concern that people will just go back to business as usual? Or do you think that as a society, we will learn from this and like looking at some of the things that you're talking about, like education, nutrition, social inclusion, housing, healthcare, will we kind of go, well, actually, those things, they were really important and we should have put a bit more thought into how we could make them more sustainable and in such a way, build them in such a way that they wouldn't go down with 2 weeks of a crisis?
Yeah, well, to go back to our first point about the way in which this lockdown is going to confront us all with the nature of spirituality, it really is a question of whether or not we reflect on the kind of crisis we're in the middle of. If we think in terms of business as usual, we're going to look out for ourselves, maximize our own benefit, and some of us, the wealthier part of the society, are probably going to be okay. The wealthier, younger, healthier section of society are going to be okay. A different way to look at it is to recognize society the way the virus sees it, which is without any distinction about gender or class or religion or ethnicity, that we're all bound together and that we're all basically the same. And when we think about it in those terms, it becomes much more sensible that we would have, for example, wide-scale, high-quality social housing, because the precarious housing situation that so many people are in is going to be a breeding ground for this virus. It makes sense that we would have a justice system that doesn't just lock people up and throw away the key, because the prisons are going to be cluster zones. And it makes sense that we would have an economy that shares the wealth more equitably than we have at the moment. After Britain and America, we're the most unequal society in the Western world economically. And we're going to start seeing the cost of that. Even the wealthiest person is going to be immune from this virus. So if we had a more equitable distribution of our economic resources, then people wouldn't be pressed into the kind of crisis situation where they have to go to work, even though they know they're sick, because otherwise they're going to be evicted. And when they get evicted, they're going to be sent to a homeless shelter where they're going to infect a whole bunch more people who are going to be making our food and delivering our packages and spreading the virus everywhere. There's no way to make ourselves safe. So if we reflect on the kind of challenge we're facing, I do think that there's an opportunity there for even the most self-interested, kind of cold-hearted self-maximizer to recognize that a different way is not only possible, it's better.
And I mean, are you hopeful, or are you thinking that after this blows over, everyone is just going to go crazy, you know, spending, ignoring everybody again, you know, just sort of wanting to get back to the madness that was our economy, and the madness that was our sort of spending, capitalistic, individualistic outlook?
At the Jesuit Centre for Faith and Justice, we like to say that we're rarely optimistic, but we're always hopeful. I don't necessarily think that we are going to embrace the opportunity to re-establish the bonds of social democracy and kind of communal equity. But we're going to work hard towards that, and we're going to pray hard that that will be the approach that we take. I don't think that we should be capitalizing on COVID to push our own agendas. This is going to be a horrendous tragedy, and every life saved is going to be something to treasure. But at the end of it, I would like to see a situation where we do commit to giving a house to every person in Ireland, or at least a home, rather, that we do get rid of the absurd waste involved in our two-tier healthcare system, and that we do put some kind of structures in place so that the massive gap and widening gap between the rich and the poor starts to close down again.